You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of CROI 2008, the 15th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections. The conference took place in Boston, Massachusetts from February 3rd through February 6th, 2008.
This is Bonnie Goldman, editorial director of the Body Pro. You're about to sit in on one of the daily press conferences at CROI 2008. You'll hear researchers discuss the findings of some of the most noteworthy studies at the conference. In this podcast, a panel of researchers will discuss recent findings on a range of studies related to HIV prevention in developing countries. They'll touch on issues including male circumcision, mother-to-child HIV transmission, and whether treating other sexually transmitted diseases can reduce HIV transmission. They'll also briefly discuss the controversial findings of a recent Swiss study suggesting that unprotected sex may be relatively safe for HIV-positive men with an undetectable viral load.
Triumph and defeat, success and failure. And that's the theme for this conference. On the success side, we have in the front row four remarkable investigators: Dr. Sawada, Waver, Gray, and Selwyn Kembo. From Uganda, and John Hopkins, who really pushed the field forward and have had the singular most important finding in HIV prevention in the last decade, and arguably in the epidemic, that circumcision of men protects men and women HIV infection. Now we learn protects men from HSV2, herpes simplex virus infection, and also improves the vaginal health of women. These are remarkable achievements, and they are going to present that, their achievements, at the award lecture, the Ngali Man lecture. That's real solid progress. And what's beautiful about it is it's a great collaboration between Uganda and the United States. So if you have something hopeful and positive in your article, I think it should highlight this. There's also good news that'll be highlighted later in the week on preventing maternal to child transmission. How best to do that? There is one caveat, though, that the harder we push with antiretrovirals to prevent transmission, the more resistance we get in babies. And that's an important thing. But progress on two fronts: circumcision, health benefits, and on maternal to child transmission. The failure, but not the defeat, we hope, the failure deals with the topic of preventive or disease-modifying vaccines. As you know, the most cost-effective public health measure is a highly protective vaccine that has eluded the best scientists in the world for over two decades, and it looks like it's going to continue for the foreseeable future. And that will be exemplified on Tuesday by presentations from academic and investigators from Merck describing the results of the STEP trial, which showed that the Adeno 5 Gag-Paul-Neff vaccine failed to protect from HIV infection. That wasn't unexpected. What was unexpected is there's a strong trend that the vaccine increased susceptibility to infection, which has led to discontinuation of trials using that product. And also, the idea that a vaccine could modify disease means prep the immune system so to control HIV better, that seems to have been refuted by the results of the vaccine trial. Secondly, on a more negative note, is the much anticipated trial of acyclovir to suppress herpes simplex virus infection. Seems not to have conferred any protective benefit for HIV infection. And this is particularly disappointing to me as a clinical and translational investigator, because there was good data and good evidence that acyclovir not only suppressed shedding of HSV2, herpes simplex virus 2, but lowered the level of viremia in those people who were on it, and lowered the level of virus in the general tract. But in a larger scale trial, no protective effect. So trying to figure out why and what the next steps are is really what this conference is about.
The RAKAI program is very honored and privileged to be able to give a number of talks at this conference. First of all, we are very, very honored to have been selected as a group to give the Ngali Mann Lecture this afternoon, which will review 20 years of collaboration between our Ugandan colleagues and ourselves. And it has really been a wonderful collaboration where, through thick and thin, successes and some real failures, the team has stuck together and has always thought, what is the next step in understanding this incredibly clever virus, a virus that no matter where we hit it seems to pop up in another direction. And we'll be reviewing some of our data both from epidemiology, a trial of STD control for HIV prevention, which didn't show any effect on reducing HIV transmission through the treatment and control of bacterial STDs. But then from that trial, which did not have an effect and was very disappointing, what we have learned about viral dynamics, transmission, what we have learned about different viral subtypes and how they act differently, but also what we learned about male circumcision and its potential protective effects in HIV-negative males, which basically added to a growing body of literature about the importance of male circumcision. And from this, we were very fortunate to be one of three groups that started a trial of male circumcision in negative males. And as you all know, and as we will briefly summarize, all three trials in three different populations had highly significant effects in reducing acquisition of HIV in negative males. Very different populations, different surgical procedures, different HIV epidemics, and yet the results were virtually identical. This is probably, for us, one of the most heartening findings and stands right up with prevention of mother-to-child transmission as a set, as an intervention that really can work. Challenges remain in its implementation, but also we will be presenting tomorrow data which suggest again how the virus is clever and how things are never as clear as one would hope for them to be. From our observational data, we had also hoped that male circumcision of positive men might reduce transmission of HIV to their negative partners. But data from a parallel trial of male circumcision in HIV positive males in our trial did not show reduced transmission to women. And indeed, if the male resumed intercourse early after circumcision, before his wound was fully healed, we have some evidence that there might be increased transmission from the positive male to the female partner. So this obviously leads to additional challenges to programs and how we will deal with this issue. On the other hand, our colleague Aaron Tobin will present data in a talk that shows, as was indicated in the earlier summary, that male circumcision does appear to have benefits for female vaginal health, and also we'll discuss the reduced acquisition of HSV2 in men who are also circumcised. So some real benefits, but also some additional challenges which arise. With respect to the RACAI program, we will also discuss some of the challenges it takes to keep a collaboration like this going. And when I say challenges, I don't mean within the group. I mean, this has just been the most fun collaboration anybody could hope and pray for. But between the virus and the real world, there are challenges galore. And I'll pass to my colleagues.
Well, we're also going to review what have we learned and what have been the challenges in trying providing or studying or carrying out all these activities in the population over 20 years. You know, community-based programs or research programs of this nature are fairly very challenging. We are often asked, how have you been in this population carrying out all these research programs for the last 20 years? It is quite a very big challenge. But I think part of the answer is going to be, and now we're going to discuss this with you, how we have been able to partner up with the community in terms of providing services to these communities. You just can't be in these communities and just carry out research activities without providing services. So we are going to discuss with you in our lecture what have we learned in terms of providing home-based voluntary testing and counseling, and what has that done to this uptake. It has dramatically increased uptake from 5% to about over 80% in provision of people knowing their results. What has been the benefit or the impact of health education over the years in these communities? We are also going to look at the challenges of providing antiretroviral treatment in these communities. Since the PEPFAR, which was initiated in 2004, we have had the opportunity to really have antiretroviral drugs at our disposal. However, providing antiretroviral drugs in the rural populations in Africa has its challenges. We are going to look at how has been the uptake, which has been fairly very reasonable, but there has been limitations in terms of using WHO staging criteria in evaluating who are eligible. For example, we find that if you use WHO in our data sets, if you just look at people who are in WHO stage 1 and 2, who are eligible, there are people who are half of our population is eligible for treatment in that stage. Yet, by definition, they wouldn't be eligible for treatments. That's missing out about half our population said that should be on treatment. We're also going to look at the fact that now circumcision can actually reduce HIV acquisition. What are our plans of really scaling this service to be available? And we are very interested in monitoring the impact on incidence. We are very interested in monitoring the impact of behavior over time. Those two remain very unanswered questions. If you provide these services, how do people's behavior change over time? We are interested in finding out, do people tend to increase their risk behavior, hoping that circumcision may give them a buffer in protection? And this is very important in long-term impact of what circumcision can do on population. So we would like to present all this and sort of share with the lessons learned in Uganda. What really has it taken? It has taken as Maria pointed out, collaboration has not, over the last 20 years, both university, government, donors, and the challenges of actually funding and sustaining this program will be discussed with this in our lecture. Yes.
Could I just also add that there are a number of posters with colleagues from this RACAI collaboration. These are particularly colleagues from Tom Quinn's lab at Hopkins, which illustrate the importance of doing studies in large populations, but being able to go down to the molecular level in your understanding of this virus. So there will be a number of posters that will look at the effects of subtype on disease progression and issues of what virus is transmitted from a positive to a negative partner. And I think it illustrates the philosophy of our colleagues that we go from the population down to the virus and the details, both biologic and behavioral, of the host to understand this terrible disease.
Could I just interject, and David introduced this, that there's really two stories here. One is of designing and executing well-conducted studies. Okay? That's a challenge in and of itself. The other story is doing that while you're juggling the egos and agenda of many people and agencies, government, donors, academic institutions. And I'm sure they all have what might be considered in retrospect amusing stories, but at the time were not so amusing, about how forces came together to try to halt what they were doing overnight. Right. Than to get a reprieve by diplomacy. And so they're all nodding, because I'm a novice in international investigation, and it can be completely bewildering at times, and unpredictable.
You talk about the number of problems there. I know this is not immediately in your sphere, but your next door neighbor, Kenya, is going through tremendous problems right now. Does that have any impact upon ongoing research efforts that you're aware of?
Not really, but there's that potential. For example, much of Uganda's imports all go through Kenya, through the port of Mombasa, and particularly then, you know, fuel. To the extent that fuel, apart from its impact on the economy, does, we run a food-based program, and if we do not have fuel, it really has an impact on our ability to carry out field activities. Or if the cost, usually when fuel shortages come up, cost goes up, so it will increase, it will combine, it will sort of compound the problems of our cost of operations. So yes, we could have problems in terms of the way we operate if this problem continues. And we are really very concerned about that.
So I want to introduce one other panel member. There's another important story that the torch is being passed to the next generation. There's no gray hair at the end of the table.
Yet.
And he's broken the size limit, too.
And Aaron Tobian. He's going to present the data on the effects of male circumcision on prevention of HSV2 infection in men and vaginal health in women. And Aaron, if you would just summarize in a minute or two what the key take-home messages are.
Okay. So, in general, herpes caused by HSV2 is associated with a 2 to 3-fold increased risk of HIV acquisition. And as you know, everyone in this room is well aware, there are 3 randomized trials showing that male circumcision reduces HIV acquisition. But the effects of male circumcision on male and female sexually transmitted infections were much more equivocal. In 2 of the randomized trials, they showed male circumcision reduces genital ulcer disease by about 50%, which suggests that other sexually transmitted infections may be reduced. Thus, we wanted to assess the efficacy of male circumcision to prevent HSV2 infection in men and also vaginal infections in women. And these are actually 2 different trials looking at secondary endpoints that CROI asks us to present in one abstract. So for the HSV2 story, there were almost 6,400 men that were initially screened, and we found 3,500 men were HIV negative and also HSV2 negative. that were also uncircumcised. These men were previously randomized, and we followed them up after 2 years. And what we found is that there's a 25% reduction in HSV2 acquisition in those men who were circumcised. Do you want to speak about the woman's study, or do you want me to?
Why don't you?
So the second trial enrolled the wives of those men who were circumcised to evaluate female transmission of sexually transmitted infections. Thus, there was over 1,600 HIV-negative females married to these HIV-negative men in the circumcision trial. And we followed them for 12 months. And what we found is those women who were married to the circumcised men had a decrease in symptomatic genital ulcer disease by 25%, a decrease in Trichomonas vaginalis by almost 50%, and a decrease in bacterial vaginosis by 20%. Thus, genital ulcer disease, HSV2, and bacterial vaginosis are all cofactors for HIV. Therefore, the findings in this study may influence the protective effect of male circumcision and HIV acquisition.
You said that you had a 25% decrease in HSV2 acquisition in your circumcised group. Did you get any sense of the effect on HIV acquisition as a result of that down regulation?
Go ahead.
This is something we're trying to sort out. We see a marked reduction in symptomatic genital ulcer disease in HIV-negative men, in HIV-positive men, and thus far in the HIV-negative wives of circumcised men. And that's about a 50% reduction in symptomatic disease in all those groups. So far, we've only seen this 25% reduction in HSV2 acquisition. So there is something else that is affecting the symptomatic ulceration. And we're in the process of trying to disentangle the mechanisms through which male circumcision may reduce HIV. A direct anatomic effect by removing vulnerable tissue, foreskin, and secondary effects by reducing genital ulceration, particularly that due to HSV2. But those analyses are in process.
So this is getting pretty complicated now. So I would ask perhaps Maria to summarize what your studies show in positives, HIV positive and negative men and their female sexual partners for the infectious diseases that you've studied.
Thank you very much. Both Aaron and myself will be presenting these data tomorrow, but we were asked to discuss this at the press conference today. Basically, now that male circumcision has been shown to reduce HIV acquisition in negative males, programs are going to be rolling out. So it's very important to also know what the effects of male circumcision might be in HIV-positive men, but also in women partners of both negative men, as Aaron was just discussing, but also of HIV-positive men. It's inevitable that some HIV-positive men will seek circumcision. Circumcision, when you think of it, it's the only HIV prevention modality intervention that leaves a physical mark on somebody. If guys are all together, bathing in the river, everybody will know who is or is not circumcised in many populations. So, for that reason, we think that positive men will seek circumcision, partly in order not to be stigmatized as the only guy in the village who's still uncircumcised. That means you must be HIV positive. The social consequences of circumcision go beyond just the intervention for HIV prevention. Thus, we conducted a trial funded by the Gates Foundation that was parallel to the trial of HIV negative men that Aaron and Ron were just discussing. In this trial, in Rakai, any HIV-positive guy who volunteered to be in a trial of male circumcision was enrolled into the Gates-funded trial and is randomized to receive immediate circumcision or circumcision delayed for 2 years. And what is more, we asked them, both the spouses of the negative men that were discussed by Aaron, but also the spouses of the positive men, were invited to participate in follow-up to see what the effects of male circumcision might be on women's spouses. Both the positive men and all the spouses signed informed consents. Everybody was provided with intensive HIV prevention education, condoms, offered free HIV counseling, offered free couples counseling. In other words, a real effort to make sure that they knew the consequences of being in a trial and that they were offered maximal protection. The main group that we will be discussing tomorrow are 93 couples in which the male was positive and the woman was negative at enrollment, and they enrolled at the same time, and the male was circumcised. And then in the control arm, 68 males who enrolled at the same time as their HIV negative female partner. And so 93 in the intervention arm, 93 couples in the intervention arm, 68 couples in the control arm, with a positive male and a negative female. These couples were followed for up to 2 years. The principal results that we will be presenting is that in the positive HIV positive males, men in the circumcision arm had approximately a 50% lower risk of having genital ulcers. So this is very much a positive effect for the males. And this is genital ulcer either observed at the time of their follow-up visits or genital ulcer that they reported having had in between the study follow-up visits. And given that genital ulceration is a serious health problem in HIV-positive men, this is a benefit. However, what we found in the women partners is that unlike we had expected from previous observational data, and I should make a quick aside, that in previous observational data prior to the trial, we had seen lower HIV rates in women married to HIV-positive circumcised men compared to women married to HIV-positive uncircumcised men. However, in the trial, we did not observe lower HIV incidence in those women who were married to the men randomized to circumcision. The rate of transmission to women married to the circumcised men was 14.4 per 100 person years compared to 9.1 per 100 person years to the women married to the uncircumcised men in the trial. The difference between these two groups was not statistically significant. The numbers in the study were small, so this did not reach significance. It could be a finding by chance alone, but nonetheless, we were not seeing a trend towards protection that we would have expected and hoped for. We are now doing much more detailed analyses as to why we may have had this unexpected and somewhat disappointing result. And what our data suggests is that the preponderance of the excess transmissions among women married to the circumcised man may have occurred in the period, post-operative period, and particularly in those couples where they reported having started sex before the surgical wound was fully certified as being healed. In other words, couples that resumed sex while there was still potential inflammation or potential friability of the surgical wound may have had a higher rate of transmission from the positive man to the positive woman. I mean, our numbers show, to the negative woman, I'm sorry, our numbers do show higher transmission. It's just, again, the difference is not statistically significant, which is why I say there may have been higher transmission. So what it does suggest is that the early postoperative period is a very important period, a period where it is imperative that people not resume sex because of the potential for increased risk. As an aside, in our trial of negative men, what we found is that the protective effects of circumcision became significant and apparent only after the six-month follow-up period. So even in negative men resuming sex after postoperatively may not, while the wound is still somewhat unhealed, may not confer any benefit, whereas once the wound is fully healed, you start seeing benefit in negative men. So the message that has to be given in circumcision programs is that whether a couple has a positive man or a negative man, it's really imperative that the couple waits to have sex until the wound is fully healed. Would anybody else like to add anything to that brief synopsis?
Yeah, I think it's also very important to put everything in perspective. Why are there results in reduction of transmission to spouses in HIV positive? Somewhat is said, but it's very important to note that the circumcision is still going to be a big benefit, because the majority of young adolescent boys in Africa are actually still negative, still HIV negative. And therefore, the impact on reduction of acquisition of circumcision could still potentially be huge.
This is absolutely right. That basically, if fewer men become negative, if fewer men become positive, those men will not be transmitting HIV to their partners. So the overall population level benefits are still very likely. We're sure there will be population level benefits.
So let's follow that nice summary with just a recap and a comment from Ron and Aaron. Just summarize one more time the non-HIV related benefits of circumcision in negative men. Their acquisition and their partner's disease.
So in HIV negative men, there's a 25% reduction in genital herpes caused by herpes simplex virus 2. And in their wives of the HIV negative men, there's almost a 50% reduction in trichomonas, a 20% reduction in bacterial vaginosis, and a 25% reduction in genital ulcer disease.
Ryan, you wanted to make a point?
Can I just add to the point that was made by Maria and David? This trial of HIV-positive men was examining a question of, does circumcision affect direct transmission from a positive male to a negative female partner? The big public health question, which will take time to answer, is not only if circumcision protects negative men from becoming infected, will we get a secondary protection of their partner, but also will the reduction of genital ulceration and other genital infections in women ultimately protect them from HIV? We do not have that answer with respect to secondary protection at this time. So there's still hope.
So population level studies are going to be imperative.
Questions? Let's start from the back and move forward.
Thank you. First, I think the work you're doing is terrific. Question. I can see in my mind why you would expect a rationale for a reduction in transmission from someone to an HIV-negative male who has been circumcised, in that the most likely targets of HIV have been cut away. I'm not sure I understand why you would hypothecate a reduction from a positive male to a female if the major source of the transmission was from the semen in the first place. Unless you're arguing that in the context you're working, there are sores that are also eliminated through circumcision, which are a cofactor or a major factor in transmission. So I'm a little bit confused. I have the United States as my model, and I can see right away why a circumcised male couldn't catch HIV as easily. I can't see the life of me why I'd expect a circumcised male to be less likely to be the source of infection if they were positive. Could you help elaborate that or explain that?
May I address that? Yes. we assume that most male-to-female transmission is via the semen. But we actually don't have evidence that that is truly the case. Our prior observational studies did show that if the male positive partner's viral load was below 50,000 copies and he was circumcised, there were no transmissions to his wife. So that strongly argued that there must be some component of male-to-female transmission via the foreskin. Whether that is due to breaches of the mucosa and ulceration, or whether there is indeed shedding of HIV from the poorly keratinized inner mucosa of the foreskin, is unknown. But these are issues that we are going to be pursuing by doing immunohistochemical and virologic studies on the foreskin specimens that we've derived from the trial. And there is a poster by Christine Johnson at this meeting showing just how incredibly rich in HIV target cells and inflammatory problems the foreskin is. So we may have underestimated the foreskin in male-to-female transmission.
And also, as you were suggesting, there is a lot of gentle ulceration that is really on the foreskin. And gentle ulcers, you know, certainly shedding of HIV from ulcers is a known phenomenon.
The fact that doing circumcision influenced transmission, not in the direction of its hope, indicates that the foreskin and that region of the genital tract are important.
Liz Heiliman from HIVandHepatitis.com. I'm wondering, especially for Maria, when you talk about resuming sexual activity after or waiting until the circumcision wound is completely healed, what time frame is that looking at?
In the HIV-positive men, about three-quarters were fully healed at 30 days, 1 month. Among negative men, it's closer to 83% who are fully healed at 30 days. So there appears to be a slightly longer healing time in the positive men rather than the negative men. Overall, to be on the safe side, we would tell men that they should not resume sex for 6 weeks, perhaps up to 8 weeks. But we're doing more detailed follow-up studies to see whether we can come up with something that is a reasonable guideline to give programs. I mean, ideally, if programs could examine everybody on a weekly basis and observe when somebody was fully healed and then say, okay, you're fully healed now, still please be careful, use condoms, etc., don't increase your risk behavior, but you're fully healed, then that would be the ideal situation. Since we know that in many programs that may not be ideal, in our health messages we will probably want to err on the side of reasonable caution. Gentlemen, do you have anything to add on that?
So we have about 5 minutes for questions. Please make them succinct.
Okay. Gus Cairns, just a very brief one. Some time ago, David, you gave a figure for the increase in uptake of voluntary counseling and testing in the community as a result of the program activities, but I missed the figures. What was the increase? You said 5% or something.
We actually pioneered trying to give results back into the homes as opposed to the participant coming to a specified center. And when we started off, about 5% of the population were interested in getting their results. But now we find that over 80% of our participants are interested and able to get their results.
And what proportion of the population have actually tested?
When we started off, our population sample was probably 1,200, but now we are talking of about 14,000 people.
In these, David, if I may just add, in these 50 communities, on an annual basis. These are the Rakai cohort communities, the population study communities that have participated with us, as David indicated, for many years. When we first started, we test everybody in the community every year. And about 90 to 95% of people each year agree to be tested, of those who are in the community. Every year, they have the opportunity to receive their results. Cumulatively, by now, of the overall population, over 90% of adults in this population know their results. There's still a small proportion who have never wanted to learn the results, and every year there's about 10 to 15% new individuals, 15% new individuals who move in, and they are entered into the cohort, they're tested, and they're offered free results. So that at the population level, it's in the high 80s, low 90s of all adults know the result. And it's cumulative because not everybody wants to get the result every year, and once they're positive, then unfortunately they don't need to get the result again. Once you're positive, you're positive. Is that fair, David?
Okay. Wow. Hands. Lots of hands. Why don't you march your way up, alternating sides?
I have a question, Salem Russell of the San Francisco Chronicle, about the ulcers. How do you define ulcerization? For instance, you either have it or you don't, or do you have the ability to detect essentially a almost microscopic ulceration? Does it have to be visible? I'm just wondering if that in some way could confound the results if you have something that isn't readily observed.
When we interview, we ask people, did they have an observed ulcer in the period of time since we last saw you, and do you have one currently, or have you had one within the past 7 days? Among people reporting a current or recent ulcer, we do a physical exam and then take a swab from that ulcer for multiplex PCR to pick up syphilis, chancroid, and herpes, HSV2. Somewhere between 50 to a third of those ulcers will reveal a pathogen, of which the overwhelming majority, over 90%, are herpes. However, in a substantial proportion of those ulcers, we do not see a sexually transmitted pathogen, which suggests that they may be either traumatic, might be an old resolved herpes that has become secondarily infected, or of other etiology. And we don't fully understand that at this time.
Okay, I need to emphasize that we're winding this up, so
yes,
brief questions, yeah. Brief answers. Right. Why don't you just come on up, alternate sides.
Maybe Emmanuel Chateau from Action, maybe you've heard about a Swiss declaration about transmission of HIV on viral mode. I know that these declarations are partially based on your study. What do you think of it? You say there is no transmission with an undetectable viral load and no STR.
This is completely unrelated. This is a study that just was published last week, showing that in individuals suppressed on antiretroviral therapy, the transmissions didn't occur. That's not part of this
It's not a study. It's just an analysis with different study. And one of the
observational data
cited is the Rakan study.
No.
Yeah. Well, I can quickly. Certainly, if there is excellent viral suppression, then from our own observational data presented over the years, we see either no or very limited transmission with very low viral loads, either for coital act or as incidence over the year. I think where one has to be careful with respect to HIV prevention is that even somebody who is well suppressed could potentially, for whatever reason, a co-infection, problems with intermittent problems with dosing, whatever, have some breakthrough HIV. viral load, detectable viral load. So I think we have to be careful not to put all our eggs in any one prevention basket. Certainly antiretrovirals are very important in reducing transmission from HIV positives, but I would no more say to somebody, just trust antiretrovirals, than I would say, just use condoms. We need to provide people with a broad range of HIV prevention services in order to truly, truly protect partners.
But does this anybody study that was published in the Swiss Journal, is that part of the RACAI project?
No.
I have not seen the study. I've just got emails about it. All I can say is that I think it is a very dangerous conclusion. And the reason is that, in our own data, we now have seen cases where at the time we tested someone, the viral load was below detection, but they transmitted. And that's because the viral load is not stable, particularly because of co-infections or possibly other factors. And so I agree 100%. We have to reinforce the prevention mechanism, messages.
Okay. Thank you. This
side. The 25% reduction seen in HSV2 acquisition in the circumcision trials, was that only in clinical disease, or were participants also screened for asymptomatic infection with HSV2 antibodies?
So that's asymptomatic. So we took everyone that was negative initially and then followed them up 2 years later by an IgG serology assay. And that's the 25% reduction.
They might have been symptomatic, but serologically, we saw a reduction in incidence.
Okay, we're going to finish up with two questions in the front.
Bob Rohr, Netscape. The results from the three African trials was very dramatic. CDC recently did a study in, I believe it was in MSM in the U.S., and they found no protection from circumcision. Could you help folks try and understand why in one setting you see it and the other you don't?
I was at the CDC meeting that considered the implications for the U.S. A, with MSM, it's much more complex because you've got both insertive and receptive behaviors. Secondly, these are observational studies, and among the MSM, there are contradictions. Some show apparent protective effects, particularly with insertive intercourse. Others do not. And I think the jury is out with respect to circumcision and MSM at this time.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been a report on CROI 2008 from The Body Pro. For more podcasts and full coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2008.